The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, welcome to IMC. I would like this morning to introduce you to a sutta, a word that means discourse, a discourse of the Buddha. There's many of them. And this one is called the Vasetta Sutta. And it's probably the primary discourse of the Buddha that's used in conversations or used as a resource for issues of race and racism. People are looking in Buddhism for some kind of reference, some kind of teaching that might be relevant for this, will often choose this particular discourse. So I thought I'd introduce it to you, and so you would know a little bit about this. And this discourse starts with two Brahmins. In ancient India, there were, in the time of the Buddha, usually people don't refer to caste for that ancient time. India nowadays is kind of has caste systems that are stratified hierarchies of different castes of people. And sometimes in India, it can be quite painful, some of the way that works. And but most people, when they think about ancient India, call it class rather than caste. I don't know exactly what the difference is. At least in English. And but anyway, there's a Brahmin class, and they're the highest class. At least they thought so. Some of them consider themselves to belong to that class because they were born into it. And so it was hereditary. And so other people were born into other classes, and that was also considered hereditary. You were born into the class of your parents, and that was your place in society, more or less. And so there were these two Brahmins who were talking, and they were having a debate about what makes a person a Brahmin. And one of them said, well, one is only a Brahmin based on birth. And it's a pure birth. So if you go back seven generations and all your ancestors have been Brahmin, then you're a pure Brahmin. You're a Brahmin as well. The other one said, no. You're a Brahmin by your actions and by the virtue you live by the observances you live by. And it doesn't matter how you're born, it matters in what you've done, what you do. So they have this disagreement. So they go to the Buddha, and they ask him, because at least for the people who composed these texts, the Buddha was someone that you want to go to and is, you know, greatly wise, and so he would have something to say. And what we have here then, when they come, is that one of the longest poems in this canon, this collection of ancient scriptures. And the poem is repeated in two places in the early Buddhist canon, indicating it was probably fairly important. And the fact that it's a long poem probably suggests that it was performed. And we say poem in English because it's, you know, four-line verses. And exactly what it was in the ancient world, we don't quite know, because it's possible it was more in that it was performed. Some scholars have called these ballads. And so there were people who'd go around and perform these in public settings. Maybe there were monastics, and laity would come. And back then there was no TV and radio, and, you know, it was most of the entertainment would happen orally, so there was a very highly developed oral culture. And so these poems represent that. So I say this because this was probably a relatively important discourse in the ancient world. So the teaching in it probably, you know, represented something important for the early Buddhist community they wanted to emphasize. So these two come to the Buddha, and they say, "A dispute has arisen between us concerning the question of birth and class. My friend says one is a Brahmin by birth, while I hold one is a Brahmin by action. This is our debate. Since neither of us could convince the other or make him see his point of view, we have come to ask you, sir, widely famed to be the Buddha. So what do you think about this? And what we'll see is the Buddha, in no uncertain terms, is going to say who is a Brahmin is Brahmin by action. That birth doesn't matter. It's how we behave and what we do. And so, sometimes the Buddha is presented as someone maybe who has no views or, you know, is above views, beyond kind of philosophy and views. But he comes in no uncertain terms and says it's by action. And what he does here is something that the Buddha does frequently, and I think Buddhism tends to do it down through the ages, is rather than rejecting some of the terms, some of the concepts of his time, he redefines them for kind of his own purposes. So you'll see as we go through this, he redefines what it means to be a Brahmin. And so he takes kind of the definition that existed in his time and kind of turns it into a Buddhist concept. So he says, there are many different kinds of living beings. First, you should know the grasses and the trees, though they lack self-awareness, their birth is their distinctive mark. Another translation of this is, the various kinds of beings, life, have distinctive marks at birth. So the redwood trees are distinct from the dandelion flowers. And they're distinctive from birth somehow by physical characteristics. Next come the moths and the butterflies, and so on through to ants and termites. Their birth is their distinctive mark. They have distinctive physical characteristic that separates them out from other insects from birth. So you recognize moths and butterflies, ants and all these insects, they're distinct from each other. Well, nowadays we'd call it different species. Then know the kinds of quadrupeds of various sorts, both small and large. Their birth is their distinctive mark. Next, know the birds that wing their way as they range in open skies. Their birth is their distinctive mark. While in these births, the differences of birth make their distinctive mark, with humans, no differences of birth make a distinctive mark. In other words, he's not going to differentiate human beings by their physical characteristics. There is no physical characteristics that allows us to make a clear distinction between one person and another in terms of, here I think he's talking about class, but we can say in modern kind of language, in race. So not in the hairs, not in the head, nor in the ears, not in the eyes, not in the mouth, not in the nose, not in the lips, and not in the brows, not in the shoulders or the neck, not in the belly or the back, not in the buttocks or the breast, not in the genitals or ways of mating, not in the hands, not in the feet, not in the fingers or the nails, not in the knees, not in the thighs, not in the color of their skin or in voice. Here, birth makes no distinctive mark, as does for other beings, other living things, other species. In human bodies in themselves, nothing distinctive can be found. Distinction among human beings is purely a verbal designation. So, we can see distinctions between physical people, like tall and short and all kinds of things. But none of those are used to distinguish people into different classes, different races, different species, different anything. We're all human species together. And then he makes this very interesting statement 2,500 years ago, that these distinctions among human beings is purely verbal designations. So at least for the class system that he was talking about in ancient India, he said these are just verbal distinctions. They're conventions that we live by. And the Buddha does this repeatedly in different ways, is to point out the role that verbal distinctions, conceptual categories, conceptual conventions that we kind of make up, are overlaid on top of our reality. And that we have to be careful about these distinctions, not to assume that the distinctions we make, the designations, the conventions, the names we make, are necessarily represent something real in the world. And all too often we can make up a noun for something, and then we live in that noun as if this is how things are, or this is the truth. And in our social world, there's a lot of social distinctions that are made of all kinds. I mean, there's probably an infinite number that we live in. And we often don't spend time to see that there are conventions that arose. Some of them arose as conventions, were invented, particular eras of human life. Certain concepts, there's a history to them, and scholars will go back and see when that history began. So like the concept of race has a particular history that does, most scholars point back the current version of this word race to Europe in the 1700s and 1800s. And it was very much a project or part and parcel of colonialism. And it was partly used then to justify subjugating other people, seeing that there were inferior and superior races, and that justified kind of the colonial rape and pillage that many European countries did around the world. And then when in the United States, this concept was also has a history. And that the word race and the concept of it, that designation, that convention, has a tremendously painful history, so much so that I think some of the most painful social divides in this country have to do around this concept of race between African Americans and whites and others, Native Americans and whites and others. And until just a few decades ago, this convention, this designation of race, was used explicitly, explicitly, but used very consciously to give preferential treatment to white people and to give them a rights to own property, to have access to some of the land grants, to get, up until the 1990s, the Department of Agriculture gave preferential loans to white tobacco growers over the black African-American tobacco growers. So a designation that, has continued until modern times, So what does it mean to live where there's a powerful designation, powerful convention that's organized so much of how people live? And how do we relate to, I think all of us in this country in some way or other, consciously or unconsciously, are relating to this idea, this convention, this designation? What is our relationship to it? What is our understanding of it? I've been reflecting a little bit lately about, partly maybe prompted by what our dear president said recently about Norwegians. So I'm an immigrant from Norway. I came as a child at a time when the United States had preferential immigration, much more than they have now. So I came from a country that had preferential, the doors were open much more openly than they were to other people back at that time. And so what does it mean to have received that and to come into a country where that, coming from that kind of benefits that came with that, that other people don't have? What is it that we don't see when we're handed or grow up with a designation, with a distinction, with a convention? And what is it we don't see about how we live in that world of that, that? So I think it's quite powerful. The Buddha highlighted that the caste system of his time was a designation, a convention. And I think in some way he had from his meditation practice, from his ability to drop deep down into meditation, I think it's one of the ways to watch how the mind works and how the mind makes concepts and ideas that we can't see so much if we're just living a busy, active life and we don't actually track and watch what our mind is doing so much. And so one of the advantages, I think, of meditation is it's the highlight, the heightened sensitivity to how this works. So then he goes on to describe somehow some of these conventions might work. He says, whoever makes their living by agriculture is known as a farmer. Whoever makes their living by crafts is called a craftsperson. Whoever makes their living by merchandise is called a merchant. And who makes their living by serving others is called a servant. Whoever makes their living by stealing is called a robber. Whoever makes their living by archery is called a soldier. Whoever makes their living by priestly craft is called a chaplain. Whoever governs is called a ruler. So he's saying that people are defined or given a name, a designation, based on what they do. And so if you don't do it anymore, then you don't have that name anymore. So here he's beginning to make his argument that designation, what you are, is by what you do, your actions, rather than something you're born into and who you are. So that, and then he's going to talk about Brahmins. I do not call a person a Brahmin because of a birth or lineage. If attachments lurk in them, he is one who is, it's a little bit hard to know how to translate this, but one translation says, he is one who is pompous. I'm not quite sure how this means, but he's a little bit being critical of these Brahmins of his time. Who has no attachments and clings no more, that is the person I call a Brahmin. So as long as someone has attachments, clinging they have, no matter if they're born into being a Brahmin or not, they're not a Brahmin. Someone who is free of their attachments, free of clinging, whether they're born into Brahmins or not, they he call a Brahmin. So someone who is born into the lowest class of India, the Buddha will call them a Brahmin if they have no clinging and no attachment. And so this idea of clinging and attachment is really a central idea for the Buddha. He puts tremendous value on it. And in a sense, he's going along with this custom of seeing Brahmins as kind of worthy people or special people. And who he's going to hold up as special, they're people who have no clinging whatsoever. So here are some examples. It goes on. It goes on for a long time in this poem, kind of to reinforce this in different ways. Who has cut off all attachments and is no more by anguish shaken, who has overcome all ties, who is unattached, I call a Brahmin. Who endures without a trace of hate, abuse, violence, and bondage, with strength of patience, is the one I call a Brahmin. Who does not flare up with anger, but is dutiful, virtuous, and humble, tamed, I call a Brahmin. Who has laid aside weapons against all beings, frail or bold, who does not kill or have them killed, is one I call a Brahmin. Who is unopposed among opponents, peaceful among those given to violence, who does not cling among those who cling, is the one I call a Brahmin. Who has dropped all lust and hate, dropped conceit and contempt, like mustard seed on the point of an owl, is I call a Brahmin. Who in this world will never take what is not given, long or short, small or big, or fair or foul, is the one I call a Brahmin. Who has crossed the further shore and meditates in the concentration states, the jhanas, is unperturbed and unperplexed, who has attained nibbana through non-clinging, I call a Brahmin. So I'm just choosing a sample of these. It goes on and on and on. And I think in the ancient oral tradition, maybe song, performance, he's just drumming this in, kind of emphasizing this. Probably it's a nice rhythm and the poetry and the song of the time. And he's like, this is what a Brahmin is. This is what a Brahmin is. And what stands out as I've read this is that, as I studied this, is most of the things that designate one as a Brahmin are not exactly actions of things we do, but rather what we've managed to free ourselves from. And so freed ourselves from hate, from lust, from anger, from clinging, from attachments, and so that we can live in the world without those. That is what the Buddha holds up as being kind of the highest status state that a person can attain. It's maybe a little bit dissatisfying to read this as so important, because sometimes we want to see that people do things as well. You know, it's not enough just to kind of live in enlightened retirement. And, just leave the world alone, not care. But I think that this is the foundation from which the positive action in the world can come. I'll say more about that in a few minutes. He goes on and says, for name and clan are assigned as mere designations in the world. Originating in conventions, they are assigned here and there. One is not a Brahmin by birth, nor by birth a non-Brahmin. By action is one a Brahmin. By action is one a non-Brahmin. Action makes the world go round. I love this because of what I grew up with, the version that said, love makes the world go round. And here the Buddha says, action makes the world go round. Action makes this generation turn. Living beings are bound by action, like the chariot wheel by the linchpin. So the Buddha is emphasizing the number of things here that I think are important. One is that he puts emphasis on action. That the word here is karma, but it means here action. And he puts that what we do, how we live, is important. And it's one of the reasons why what's called sila, sometimes as ethics, is so important in Buddhism. It's considered the foundation, the beginning of Buddhist practice is to be ethical. And that's supposed to be but that's not just the beginning of Buddhist practice. Being ethical is the end of Buddhist practice. In fact, some of the most common ways that the enlightenment is defined in the suttas is in ethical terms. And so it's kind of like becoming, you know, someone's enlightened because they become ethical. Enlightenment and ethics are kind of like the same thing almost, becoming ethical. They're so closely connected. And, you know, when I was a new Buddhist practitioner, I didn't understand that. I thought, oh, ethics is what you do, kind of like, you know, kindergarten Buddhism. And, I didn't really understand how central it is to this whole enterprise of Buddhism. I thought you kind of get your stuff together a little, just enough so you can meditate and go on to the important things. And it turns out one way to understand the important things and the progress and growth of practice in Buddhism is that it's an ethical growth, it's an ethical maturity that goes on. And that at first, Buddhists will follow precepts and follow ethical guidelines sometimes out of a sense of duty, sometimes because it's been handed down through your family, sometimes because your teacher tells you to, or whatever. It's kind of like something that you take on. But as people practice, there tends to be a shifting relationship with sila, with ethics, with the ethical guidelines, with the precepts. And they're no longer, at some point, they no longer become something external that we take on, or duty, or requirement, but they start having a life inside of us. And they become something that we're inspired to live by, because they speak to something very important that we sense and feel inside of us. We feel that there's a clarity, a purity, a cleansiness, a cleanliness, a wholeness. I don't know what the right language is for different people, that is violated or hurt or destroyed or contracted when we live unethically. And so to move towards greater freedom, to greater openness, has a lot to do with not succumbing to unethical behavior, but staying ethical. And then being ethical becomes more and more an internal guide. We get an internal guide for what that is. And we follow that internal guide to fill out, to expand what it means to be ethical. And then at some point, in this maturation process that Buddhism describes, ethics, sila, being, doing things like not killing and stealing and sexual misconduct and lying, becomes not something that one is, something inside of you that guides you, that you're trying to live by, but rather it becomes who you are. That the forces inside that would prompt unethical behavior no longer is there. And so there's this idea of being non-attached, non-clinging, is very much having to do with those forces that would lead us to be unethical, lead us to hate, lead us to be greedy, lead us to do kind of unethical behavior. And so then they say that it's with a full maturation of enlightenment, a person is defined and described by being ethical. So we start with kind of a sense of duty, or just like take it on as something we've been told is good to do. And then it becomes our own, becomes a guide, and then at some point it becomes who we are in a sense. So this process of maturation in Buddhism can be seen as ethical all along the way. So here in this text here, the Buddha is describing ethics, but mostly from the point of view of what we let go of. Like of attachment, clinging, hate, anger, and all these things. And I think of this as partly a process of relaxation, if that doesn't belittle the whole conversation, that a lot of these forces of anger and hate and clinging and attachment, lust, represents forces of tension that are carried in the system here, in the mind, in the heart, in the body. And people who live with tremendous tension all the time, whether it's stress from their environment or from whatever, tend to respond more from a certain aspect of our humanity that lends itself to more harmful behavior. People who hurt, as the saying goes, are more likely to hurt others. People who are healed are more likely to be interested in healing others. People who are in a lot of pain tend not to want to touch their pain or to feel it, and so they recoil from it and sometimes direct it outwards in terms of hate and other things as well. And so, you know, we have this idea of fight and flight when there's a lot of stress and a lot of danger that comes up. And I think that's a reaction from certain kinds of physiological mechanisms that tend to operate more strongly when we're under stress. There's a whole other side of us, that other way of operating, that is considered kind of the opposite of fight or flight, which is approach and soothe. And so, so a parent who has a young child who's hurt themselves, hopefully won't run away, they will approach the child and soothe the child. And we have this whole system of empathy, of different kind of hormones in our system that kind of predispose us towards this approach and soothe kind of approach. which tends to work better when we're relaxed, when there's no tension. So as we let go of these kinds of things that the Buddha is talking about here and become more unattached, non-clinging, it shifts the part of this human's responsivity that we have from those kinds of responses that come from stress and tension to those that come from being relaxed and open. And then we have greater access to things like compassion, greater access to loving kindness, greater access to empathy that goes on. And in fact, sometimes the Buddha doesn't say this explicitly, but there are times where in the suttas where he describes someone who's let go quite deeply, and then in the next passage he's just describing how now they have lots of loving kindness and compassion. And the descriptions of it are quite beautiful, how boundless those are. It's almost like he doesn't explain how he got how they got there from letting go to compassion. And I think it's because he just knows that it happens kind of automatically once we shift where we go. So here in this country, we cannot avoid, unfortunately, the concept of race and trying to get wise about how to navigate that, to understand it, how to understand our own relationship to it, and try to understand ourselves in the different ways that maybe we haven't understood what it means to be white or African-American or whatever the background we are. And to understand it deeper and deeper, I think, is a kind of responsibility for being in this country. And so how do we, you know, address it? And one way I think that maybe I hope is a help with this is to go from places of tension and the forces that operate when we're tense to forces that operate when we're open and not holding on so much. And I represent this in with the word brace. We brace ourselves. There's all these, when we're tense and brace ourselves to life, then we're more likely to operate from positions of bias. More likely to live with barriers and boundaries between people. They're more likely to experience or to put up boulders for people to find their way through life and to make their way. We bully people, all these B's that go with brace. We bully people, the people who are in the, you know, the more dominant positions in this kind of race thing. But if we take away the B, we end up with race. But if we add G, we get grace. And I think that's, I don't know all the words that we want to associate with, you know, the transformation to into this other half of who we are. But some of the things that we add with grace are goodwill. We add generosity. We add goodness. Maybe we add gratitude. That these are, you know, these kinds of forces of goodwill and goodness of who we are, the ethical side of us that tends to come out when we don't cling and don't live under tension or not braced against life, are some of the things that are needed in our society. And we need it towards ourselves, we need it to others, so that, you know, that we can somehow find a way to transform the fault lines of our society around race to something that everyone has equal opportunity, everyone has a place to feel at home and comfortable in our society with each other. So this discourse has been used, often referred to in these kinds of conversations here in the West, and I don't know all the issues that come up for people in this kind of discourse and whether how useful it is for in the conversations going on here in the West around issues of race and other designations people have. But for those of you who might be useful, some of these ideas, this is the, you know, often used as a reference. So, do you have any comments? We have about 5 minutes. And yes, we have the mic up here.
So Gil, there's an ancient Indian saying which says that it is totally irrelevant to discuss the origins of two things. Maybe for other things it's okay, but it's a river and a wise man, a wise person, a sage. In India there are two big rivers, the Ganga and the Yamuna. They start off as puddles in Himalayas. So this theme is very recurrent in a lot of the Indian texts. Like in Gita, it says that all the books and texts are as much use to a wise man as a well when there is flood everywhere. And so that it makes me wonder, when I was in grad school, professors, they like to have their pictures taken in their library with a ton of books. And it always makes me wonder, so did these people, do they want to convey the information that they've read all these books, or it always makes me wonder.
Now I'm self-conscious that I brought this big fat book. Thank you. Oh, you have one.
So this is kind of a technical question about the. So this poem sounds a lot like the specific area in the Dhammapada where he refers about the Brahmins, that section. Is this where a lot of that was maybe constructed, Gil?
Yeah, there's a whole chapter of an anthology of ancient verse. It's called the Dhammapada. And the last chapter of that is very similar to this. It kind of redefines what it means to be a Brahmin. And I think some of these verses are there, but I think also there's other verses that are pulled from other places that are added to that.
So I have a question. I'm interested in your comments. So we live in a much more complex world and a much more mixed world than the Buddha did. We're from cultures all over the place, some very recent, some not so recent. How does that play into this mix in the talk you've just given? What's the maybe I should ask that a little differently as I'm thinking it. What's the effect of so many different cultures mixing together as opposed to a more homogeneous society? And in this particular country, certain places are not mixed at all. They're very homogeneous, and others are. How does that play into all of this?
I probably don't know. It's a big question, but I hope it just makes us better and better people. And we learn from each other and support each other and celebrate each other, appreciate each other, and that's what I hope it means. But what it actually means, see, it's a big topic. I feel reluctant to pick it up.
So I'm just experiencing that this was a very profound talk. And I appreciate that. That's it.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, I hope it's okay. I mean, it's a sensitive topic. I felt I had a lot of doubts of whether it was appropriate or what I had to say was useful on this topic and what kind of harm I might cause by saying this, talking about this topic. But I just, there was kind of, this is what was up for me and what I felt I had, you know, was in me to speak about. And sometimes when that I kind of have to go with that, otherwise the alternative is just to, I don't know what, be silent. Sometimes that's better, but anyway, I hope that what I said today is certainly hasn't caused any harm in my attempt to try to cover this topic. It's a very sensitive topic and one that I feel is very important but hard to understand. And it's hard to talk about it also in my particular position in our society as a white man and white man of, you know, I'm sitting on a high platform, so, you know, white man of authority and variety of things. So it's something that, you know, that is a work in progress for many of us. So thank you all. And we have the tea today. You're all welcome to stay. And what would be really lovely, so here at IMC, kind of what we try to have here is open doors, where this is available for the community in such a way that anybody who's here, it's your place. So if this is your first time here, you're very welcome here, but you're also kind of welcome to for this hour you're here to make it your home, or you know, everybody, it belongs to everyone. And, but I say that because this is your first time here, and if you've been here many times before, either way, if you don't mind, turn to the person next to you or one or two people next to you and say hello and welcome them here.